Okay, I think it's 3 o'clock now, so I think we can start. And today I've chosen a number of small suttas from the Sanyutta Nikaya. As you may know, if you've seen this particular collection of teachings, they're very short teachings, which means that you can't just choose one and just discuss that on a sutta class. So I put a couple together on the theme of this one is the Nidana Sanghita, which is the dependent origination, with some sort of definitions of what these terms are, and also some other interesting parts of this particular teaching of the Buddha. So it's basically the teaching on dependent origination with a few little additions. And hopefully that I can continue like that to start giving some teachings from Sanyutta Nikaya. And of course, one of the reasons is because every talk which we've done on the middle length sayings of Majjhima Nikaya always gets recorded. So every sutta has been done before. And if anybody wants to find out what it says, they can always just go on the website and they can download it. So this is new stuff. And it gives a wider, deeper description of the teachings. Okay, so now we'll do the Namatasa and then we can begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
Okay, so the suttas which I've chosen. First of all, we're going to do the second sutta and then go up to the tenth sutta of this section, the Nidana Sanyutta, the collection of short teachings on the dependent origination. Nidana means cause. And I'm starting with the second sutta first because this gives a definition of the terms. And it's important that people hear the definition of the terms because many monks, whether it's the Sri Lankan Jnanavira or the Thai Buddhadasa, have sometimes distorted the teachings of dependent origination, basically because they haven't really looked at what the Buddha said these terms actually mean. And when you listen and see what the Buddha actually said these terms mean, it really becomes quite clear that the traditional understanding of dependent origination is the authentic one. And all the interpretations which modern monks have made are really out of step with how the Buddha taught. So you may have heard about the links of dependent origination. Now here the Buddha is actually describing what each one of them means. This was at Sawati, and the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, I will teach you dependent origination, and I will analyze it for you. Listen to that and attend closely, I will speak." "Yes, Venerable Sir," those monks replied, the Blessed One said this. What, monks, is dependent origination? And it is, "With ignorance, I prefer delusion as a condition. Volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as a condition, consciousness comes to be. With consciousness as a condition, we have a name and form, nama rupa, comes to be. With nama rupa as a condition, the six sense bases come to be. With the six sense bases as a condition, contact comes to be. With contact as a condition, feeling comes to be. With feeling as a condition, craving comes to be. With craving as a condition, clinging comes to be." I prefer the translation of fuel. And with fuel as a condition, we have the existence comes to be. With existence, birth comes as a condition, birth comes to be. With birth as a condition, aging and death comes to be. And such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. That's the dot, dot, dot. That's the standard explanation of dependent origination. And now just to see if those translations or my renderings make any sense, we have the Buddha's definition of them. So what, monks, is aging and death? The aging of various beings in the various orders of being, their growing old, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of vitality, degeneration of the faculties. This is called aging. And you only have to look around to see examples of that. Quite a few. I'm not looking at anyone in particular. So it is quite clear from the Buddha's description, it does actually mean aging and death, as is commonly understood. The passing away of the various beings from the various orders of beings. They're perishing, their break up, disappearance, mortality, death, completion of time, break up of the aggregates, the laying down of the carcass. This is called death. And these are all of the simile or the metaphors, the idioms for dying in the time of the Buddha. Now, things like disappearance, mortality, completion of the time, those were all the ways that we would describe death in Pali. These days, we'd also include such sayings as kicking the bucket. What other sayings have they? I'm sure that in Sri Lankan, in Chinese, in all the different languages, there's always different idioms for dying. You know, which is any interesting ones like kicking the bucket? What's a nice one in Sri Lankan? Similarly, you don't know? In Chinese? For dying? Gone from this world, yeah. So gone from this world. Yes, if you can interpret that as some astronaut has gone into outer space. But that's obviously not what it really means. What it really means is, you know, dying. And thus this aging, thus this death are together called aging and death. So this is aging and death as it is commonly understood. It's not some symbolic meaning of aging and death like the aging and death of some mental qualities like you're happy and happiness ages and dies. It means the aging and death of the various types of beings. And what, monks, is birth? The birth of the various beings into the various orders of beings, their being born, descent into the womb, production, the manifestation of the aggregates, that's the five khandhas, the obtaining of the sense bases, this is called birth. And this too were the various idioms of something being born, not just a human being, the various beings into their various orders, you know, such as in the Digha Nikaya, they expand on this and say the heavenly beings into the heavenly being order, humans into humans, the four-legged beings into the four-legged of beings, those which creep on the ground into the creeping on the ground type of beings, every being, birds into the state of birds, all the various orders of beings. So once again, this means birth as it is commonly understood, not the birth into some emotional state or some mental state. It means birth as is commonly understood. And what, monks, is existence? There are these three kinds of existence: sense-sphere existence, form-sphere existence, and formless-sphere existence. This is called existence, or being. Now, who knows here, to keep the class awake on a hot afternoon, what those three forms of existence are? What does it mean by sense-sphere existence? This world, is that all? Devaloka as well, is that all? Hell realm as well, yes, and the ghost realm and the animal realm. This is called in Pali Karma Loka. Loka means world, as this is Dhamma Loka. That's the wrong word, because it's Dhamma Loka, which means the light of the Dhamma. But sometimes Loka means world. And so this Karma Loka means the world of the five senses, and that is for the heavenly beings, the devas. It also means the beings, human beings, animals, ghosts, and hell realm beings. Yeah, that's all part of the world of the five senses. So what does it mean next by a form sphere existence? That's Rupa Loka. Who knows what that means? Sorry? Brahma realm, yeah, the jhana realms. These are the realms which are equivalent to the experience of jhana in this life. Mind-made bodies, where you experience just the same experience you experience in jhanas, only for a long time later. This is another part of Buddhist cosmology, places where you can exist in. These are states of existence. The first Kamaloka is a whole range from hell realm, ghost realm, animal realm, human realm, and the heavenly being realms, up to just the members of the Brahma's realm. And then beyond that, we have the jhana realms. That's called the form sphere existence, or sometimes called fine material existence. And lastly is the arupa existence. If you see this in Pali, the formless, it's quite easy to understand that this is that realm of existence where people can exist for long periods of time, experiencing the same as you experience in the formless attainments. So here the Buddha is extending the cosmology, not just the hell realms, human realms, animal realms, and heavenly realms, but extending it to existences, forms of existences, which are really based on those meditative attainments of the jhanas and the immaterial attainments. To say those are the three, if you like, states of existence one can be reborn into. So these are states of existence. Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, so what am I saying to same people, that if you attain sort of an immaterial attainment, that sort of jhana, and at the time of your death you manage to re-experience that, then you'll get reborn into that state, or sometimes you can get even better than that, but at least you get reborn into that state. The same state, incredible stillness, so stable, timeless, that you're there for long periods of time. You don't recognize the passage of time, no more than people in deep meditation recognize that an hour has gone past or a day has gone past. You go into a very beautiful, peaceful, timeless state. I know that sometimes people say, and this is a common misunderstanding, they said, oh, but in that state, you know, it's a waste of time. You can't do anything. You're stuck there. Yes, while you're in those states, you cannot do anything. You're stuck. You're having a wonderful time. But it does leave a residue when you come out. And the residue is the peace, the happiness, the fact that the five hindrances have been abandoned. So if a person descends from the say the arupa realm, say gets reborn in this human realm, their five hindrances will be so weakened. They'll be very, very peaceful and saintly human beings. So that is why you don't lose anything by getting into these states. It's just an important purification of your mental faculties, which will be there after the state declines and you get reborn into another realm. But in particular, this particular explanation is saying that this word means states of existence, places where you can be reborn into.
I know this is definitely your common spirit.
Yeah.
But I do know that, or maybe I'm wrong, but this word.
Yes.
It only applies within the Buddhist dispensation, that the people who are view of the distant income, then the distant, you know, from outside the dispensation, even if you get the distant income, you get all chances of your fall further.
It's a very good question. It is easier, if you have right view, good teachings, to let go to such a degree that you can attain to something like a jhana. But there's also what you're letting go of to get into these deep meditations is your control, your will. That is the biggest hindrance. And there is another, when reading medieval Christianity, there were some saints, in particular St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, who were around the same time. What was that, about 13th, 14th century? in a common era. And those, from their descriptions, you can't be sure, but it seems to imply that yes, they did achieve states of jhana. And I think it's possible simply because their practice was abandoning their will into their idea of a god. So they were totally renounced their own personality, their own being, their own will, and totally giving up to the will of their idea of a superior being. And I could understand how that can be a form of letting go, which will take them into a jhana experience. And of course, also, they would experience that as a union with the divine, with God. And if anyone has ever experienced the jhana, you can understand why, when they emerge afterwards, that is how they would interpret it. Basically, they have disappeared simply because their will, the one which controls, is in charge, has totally vanished. And number two, incredible bliss. And a lot of times people experience that bliss, or rather interpret it, as pure love, infinite love. And they would come out afterwards and say, well, look, I wasn't there. This is the experience. That must have been union with God. And of course, my joke is that anyone who gets in a jhana here, it's such a shame that you're a Buddhist, because if you were a Christian and got into that jhana, you'd become a saint. And they'd name a school after you. It would be St. Cheng's school. Oh, you go on. Enlightenment. Oh, if yes, without knowing the Buddha's teachings, can they make that further jump and get insight? It's very unlikely. It's like, no, it literally is like finding the needle in the haystack. It's much better if you have some sort of map that you know where the needle is likely to be. So the map is the teachings of the Buddha. So thank you for that. But the main point here is that these are states of existence where the stream of consciousness can get reborn into. And what bhikkhus is clinging? Upadana. And upadana, clinging, sometimes called attachment, literally means the taking up. And I don't need to teach you too much Pali, but many of you have taken the five precepts. No, the second precept is adinna adana. Adinna means not giving. Ardhana means taking. And it's the same phrase there, the same ardhana as in upa ardhana. It literally, ardhana means taking. And upa literally does mean taking up. The English language is an Indo-Aryan language. In other words, many of the roots come from the Indian linguistic tradition. And this has actually come through. And upa literally has one meaning, taking up. And when you understand it's taking up, you can feel that taking up can be an attachment, can be a cling, you're taking it up. It can also be the idea of a fuel, in the same way that the flame takes up the wax as its fuel. And that is also a very powerful simile, which gives you an idea of what this word means. It's a taking up, it's the fuel, it's taking up the fuel of existence and actually becoming a new form of existence. And so what actually is this upadana? They don't really say what the upadana is here. It is what the upadana actually takes up. The four types of fuels. And here, thinking of it as fuel means it gets a much more evocative meaning of what's happening here. So I'm going to call it fuel. There are the four kinds of fuels. The fuel of sensory pleasures. I mean, this is only refers to the five senses, by the way. This is very clear. We don't have a word which, in English, which is just for the five senses and is not related to the sixth sense of the mind, because Western philosophy doesn't even admit that there is a mental sense. We've only got five senses. But the word sensory pleasures here, when you hear it, always means towards the five senses. The sixth sense of mind is not included. So the sort of clinging or using the mental pleasure as a fuel does not exist here. These are the sensual pleasures, the pleasures of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. And there is the fuel of views. And again, the idiom is whenever they say a view, it always means the wrong view. Because you all know, as a Buddhist, we are supposed to cling to view, right view. You're supposed to cling to that one. That's the part of the raft which we must cling on to if we're crossing over the stream. I know that sometimes people think that as Buddhists we should not attach or cling to anything. And my rejoinder is, if you're on the back of a motorcycle, please cling on to it. Don't let go until the motorbike has stopped. So it literally means the fuel of wrong views. The fuel of rules and vows. And this is sila and vata. Vata means duties or rules. For example, in our monasteries, you know, we have, you know, it's a Thai word, we call it korwat. And that's a Thai word coming from this vata, this duties, responsibilities, what you should do. And so what this really means, it doesn't mean that you should abandon all of your precepts and abandon all of your duties and practices. What it does mean is understanding that that is not enough. It was the delusion in the time of the Buddha, and always been since, that just through a set of practices, such as chanting some name of somebody, or by doing your homage to the Buddha statue or any other statue, by just external rites and rituals, that would be sufficient to gain freedom. And of course, it's not sufficient. It doesn't mean it's wrong to do. This is the idea that this is all you have to do. You don't have to meditate, just chant, just practice your precepts, and that's you get to enlightenment. No, there's more to it than that. There's a whole Eightfold Path. And that's the so-called fuel of the addiction to rules and vows. And lastly, the fuel of a view or doctrine of a self. And this meaning of self here is atta. It literally means an essence. Now, a core principle or thing which goes from moment to moment, day to day, life to life, which you identify with as being me, my core, my essence. So those are the four fuels. And if any of those fuels are there, it actually creates the new existences. Yes. Go on, yes. Sorry. Oh, you want the microphone? Okay, yes.
Can I dare say, yeah, therefore, please, that yes, among all the fetters, yes, Silabhata Paramasa is about the easiest to get rid of, therefore?
It is the easiest to get rid of. The idea that just by doing simple practices like chanting or keeping precepts is sufficient. But nevertheless, all of these fuels or clinging, they are very sticky. And if you've been practicing that for a long, long time, it's very hard for a person to suddenly abandon it. So you know, if your parents, your teachers, monks or nuns you respect have said, no, all you need to do is to keep on doing these rites and rituals, and then you know, you'll become a stream winner or even enlightened. It's so hard to abandon that when you've been practicing it for such a long time. Even though that sometimes you realize, no, it makes no sense at all why I'm doing this. And nevertheless, because you've been doing it such a long time, there's a great resistance to change.
The cost of giving it up.
Sorry?
The sort of devastating view that everything that's done...
I've done for years and years was a waste of time. All the donations I was given, like, was putting my money into the fire. Nothing really I was doing was worthwhile. And of course, that can be very, very hard to accept. Okay, and the next factor is craving, dānha. And that is also has another meaning in Pali, which is very evocative as well, is thirst. In the same way, if you didn't have enough water before you came in here, it's hot, it's dry, you may feel thirsty. That is another meaning of the word for dunha, or craving. You can understand what it really means as an experience now. You just have to get some water. You feel very uncomfortable without this. It is a craving which stops you being at peace. And again, the Buddha was talking about not so much what craving is, but the objects of craving. And he says there are six classes of craving. The craving for forms, which is what you see with the eye. The craving for sounds, what you hear with the ear. Craving for odors, craving for tastes. Craving for tactile objects, what you feel with your body. And craving for mental phenomena, what you know with your mind. This is called craving. So it doesn't give too much explanation of what craving actually is. Was talking about the objects of those cravings. And here, it is the craving for sensory experience. And what, monks, is feeling? And again, there are these six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact. This is called feeling. So again, not really saying what the feeling is, but saying there's a different type of feeling for every one of the six senses. And again, we have not got an equivalent word in English for the Pali word Vedana. It literally means that quality, the effective quality with every sensory experience, which is pleasant or unpleasant. And in English, we give every sense a different name for those two qualities. If it's pleasant with the eye, we call it beautiful. If it's unpleasant with the eye, we call it ugly. If it's pleasant for the ear, we call it maybe sonorous or sweet-sounding. Even sweet-sounding, we borrow from the taste. Or we may call it discordant. Now, if it's pleasant for the nose, it's called fragrant. If it's unpleasant for the nose, it's called smelly or stinky. And again, pleasant for the mouth, tasty, sweet, whatever you wish to call it. If it's unpleasant, you may call it bitter. And obviously, for the physical sense, painful and pleasure, and for the mind, it can be inspiring, depressing. There's many, many words, but if you can get that idea of all of those words, the pleasant, agreeable quality of every sense experience, we call that sukha vedana, the happy feeling. And if it's unpleasant, you know, bad taste, bad feeling, a bad thought, and it's unpleasant in your mind, that is called unpleasant vedana, dukkha vedana. So this is a vedana, is a quality through every sense experience which is either pleasant, agreeable, or unpleasant. Yes? Okay, I can just repeat this. Asking piti and sukha, is one a mental feeling and one a physical feeling? This is really important when you look at the deep meditations. But in practice, it's not worthwhile trying to distinguish those things until you really have got some very deep meditations. The only way I say this, the only way you can really understand what the difference is when you have at least attained a third jhana. Because up to that time, those two, piti, sukha, are always together, like inseparable twins. When you see one, you see the other in all experience of life. And this is the first time in the third jhana, and obviously beyond, when part of that inseparable combination vanishes. The sukha is there without the piti. And that is the first time that has occurred for you. So it's only really then can you understand what piti is and what sukha is. So please don't try to be concerned about that, to think about that, or to try and find out, you know, from linguistic analysis what those two terms mean. They're both enjoyable, joyful, pleasurable. And to find out what each one means is too difficult. And you'll get it wrong until you experience quite a few third jhanas. And so that is a feeling. And what is contact? Now this again is the Buddhist way of understanding sensory experience. There are these six classes of contact. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact. This is called contact. It doesn't really say very much what contact is. But this is the idea in Buddhism that you need a sense base, such as the eye or just as say the tongue for taste, and you need sense objects, you know, such as something to taste or something to see. If we had a dark room, even though your eyes may be perfect, you still can't see anything. There's no light coming through, it's totally dark. So you need an object, you need the sense base, and the coming of those two together, you know, is the arising of the consciousness. In other words, that consciousness turns on, and those three coming together is called contact. In other words, it is like the contact of turning on the electricity, turning on the light. When that switch goes click, then electricity flows, there is light. When these three come together, the sense base, the sense object, and the corresponding consciousness, the sense has happened, it's turned on. So that's why they use the word contact, because these things, they come together. And then there is what we know as sensory experience. That's the Buddhist idea of what the sensory experience is. A sense base, an organ by which you can could actually feel or know or see. And it's not just the eye. It's just the eye and all the sort of the stuff in the brain which is connected to your eye consciousness. That is all the sense base. The physical part of what allows you to see. And it needs the object and it needs the consciousness coming to those two come together, turning on consciousness. And then there's the contact, the sensory experience. For example, you know, you as you're listening to me, you know, you do have physical feeling. That sense base is there. And there is a sense object, the feeling in your bottom. But until I told that, those two were there, but the consciousness hadn't sort of also arisen to bring the three together. That basically didn't exist. So you do need those three coming together for sensory experience to happen. And that is called contact. The thing which we call experience. A base, an object, and the consciousness as well, or that particular type of consciousness, and then we have the experience. Is that clear for you? Because that's an important part of Buddhism, and it's mentioned many, many times, and sometimes, because it's different to the way that we've been taught in the West, it takes a while for you to get accustomed to that particular framework for understanding the experience of the six senses. Okay. And what are the six sense bases? That's easier. Once you understand where we're coming from, you understand you do need six sense bases. You need a sense base to have a contact. What are the six sense bases? The eye base, the ear base, nose, tongue, body, and the mind base, the six sense bases. These are called six sense bases, and I've often noted Aristotle also agreed there were six senses, but it's weird. I really wanted to know why it was that now in the West we only have five senses. And that's why a few years ago the sixth sense was a movie. But we've always had six senses in ancient Greek philosophy and also Indian philosophy, including Buddhism. And now we've got this thing called name and form. What monks is name and form? This is the Nama Rupa. And this is, for those of you who really get into the Buddhism, this also is a point of great confusion. Because the suttas, such as here and everywhere else, makes a very clear definition of what Nama Rupa is. But the Abhidharma changed it. This is that third group in the Tripitaka. They changed the original teachings here and caused a huge amount of confusion. Because they actually included consciousness in their definition of name and form. But here, the suttas, as taught by the Buddha, it's very clear. What is this thing we call Nama Rupa, name and form? If you ever do Vipassana meditation, you know, this is such a huge thing, name and form, Nama Rupa. But because most of that Vipassana comes from the Burmese, they give it a different interpretation of what you see here because they follow the Abhidharma rather than the suttas. And they are different. So what is Nama Rupa, name and form? Feeling, which we've already understood, is that quality of pleasure and pain with any of the six senses. Perception, and the perception here is actually part of the sensory experience. We have something, we understand it for ourselves. We take a part of that experience, and we understand it, we perceive it as like, you know, white shirt or, you know, blue carpet. That idea of white, blue, old, young, men, woman, that distinguishing of some prominent features is how we experience the world. And you ask any psychologist, our perception is very efficient. We only choose what we or what we believe in that moment to be important. That's what we perceive, and everything else, all the other stuff, is like so much background noise, we don't even know it. And the classic example of that was, you know, that experiment done in Harvard with the door. There was the psychologist and the victim. The psychologist went to ask any victim they saw on campus a simple question: which is the way to the chemistry building, or something like that. And before the person, the victim, could answer, two people dressed as workmen, who also, you know, part of the experiment, came between the two people, the psychologist and the victim, with a huge door. And so for maybe 10, 15 seconds, the two people couldn't see each other. But then they were through, and then the person could ask the question again, which is the way to the chemistry lab? And the trick was, the first person who asked that question of the victim went along with the door and was replaced by a second person. So the first person who asked the question, where's the way to the chemistry lab? And the door came between them. And then the person said the same question, where's the way to the chemistry lab? They wanted to find whether the victim could notice the change in the person. And they had wonderful combinations, you know, male and female, Afro-American and Caucasian, a short Chinese guy, and a huge sort of Mexican guy, and dressed totally differently. And most times, the victim, the person being asked a question, didn't realize it was a different person asking the question the second time. And it was one of those experiments which showed that when you listen to a question on campus, it doesn't matter, it's not important who asked the question. That's so unimportant, you don't even perceive it. It does not register. All you register is a question. So door comes between you, the people swap, and the person asks the question again. It's the same question. It gives you that continuity. You don't realize it was a different person who asked the question. And it was one of those examples of how perception works. It is just how we take some information, name it, give it importance, and that's all we know. And it's a fraction of what actually is out there, our perception. So, is that clear what perception is? You know, you go on any psychology website and you can find out all these incredible experiments about the nature of perception. Yes. It's called sanya, yes. Perception is sanya in Pali, yes.
Does that also include memory?
Include memory. Now that's a very good question, because it involves memory. Because how we know things is how we've been taught to see them, which really does involve memory. Which is, you know, why when you first move to a different country, like when I first moved to Thailand, they all look the same. Even the monks, the first time I saw the monks in Wat Pa Phong, they all look the same, all bald-headed. How do you know? They all dress the same. How can you know which monk is who? And of course, after a while, your perception starts to pick up the differences between people. If you've ever seen identical twins, I don't know the difference between them, but the mother always knows the difference, because they live with them so long, they can actually, they've refined their perceptions. So this is what perception is, like how we identify, how we know things. There's a lot of memory involved in that. And that memory is, again, just how we've been taught. Instead of calling it memory, we can call it conditioning, brainwashing, ways you see things. I don't want to go too far into condition, into perception. It can become, get quite scary, because we see things in one particular way. We've been taught to see them in one particular way. And that does affect our worldview. We have an election campaign on, federally and state. I know that because this morning a federal MP came to lunch here trying to get some more votes. So you can see that a federal campaign is on. It's the only time you ever see ministers or people when they need something. Actually, the only time they ever see me when I need something too, but I can understand that. But you can see just how the advertising, how the posters are all there to change our perceptions. And this is actually how perception works. It is manipulated. When you see how much it's manipulated, wow, that's scary. But that's another talk. But that's part of... Yes, Cheng? Okay, can I just finish the Nama Rupa then? Because I've only got to... Yeah, I'll just finish the Nama Rupa and then I'll get to your question. Because I've only got to perception so far, Nama Rupa. The next one is volition, choice, will. This is part of what we call Nama Rupa. And then we have the contact, which you just described, and attention. This is called name. And the four great elements, and the form derived from the four great elements, this is called form. Basically, stuff, material stuff. Also air, space, that's all dependent upon the four elements of, you know, air, fire, wind and water. That's what, you know, they used to call stuff as. So they have the form is the stuff, the material stuff. The name is feeling, perception, volition, contact, attention. Basically, if you look at that, that's the three middle khandhas. Feeling is feeling, perception. The most important part of the fourth khandha, sankhara, is called volition. So you can see that name and form, you've got the form like rupa stuff, you've got feeling, perception, volition, contact, attention. That represents the three next khandhas. Consciousness is outside of nama rupa. And that is part of how the Buddha taught. He gave another simile elsewhere that consciousness is like one sheaf of reeds, of like hay, if you like. Nama rupa is another sheaf of reeds. They have to be together. They support each other. If you take one away, take consciousness away, there can't be any nama rupa. You take the nama rupa away, there cannot be any consciousness. The two depend upon each other, as we'll find out in a moment. So that's name and form, nama rupa. Okay, Cheng, what question did you have? When you have jhana, it's a mind consciousness, yes.
Alone. All those descriptions of jhana are actually
nama rupa description. It's sort of nama rupa description, but for those of you who look on the web, there is a controversy about the jhanas. When I first started teaching jhanas, no one else was really teaching them. The controversy is that in the jhanas, can you feel the body? And there are still some monks, nuns, lay people who said, yes, you know, if you even first jhana, you can still hear things, you can still feel the body. And of course, you've heard my teaching so much say, no way, you can't do that. And I quote many places in the suttas where you can't. So yes, I agree with you. In a jhana, the five senses, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, have been turned off. They're not there anymore. You have just the mind consciousness and the mind objects. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, very good. What you're saying there is nama rupa, which is one of the descriptions I've often used. So nama rupa being the object of consciousness. So with that simile of the sheaves of reeds, to have consciousness, you need an object of consciousness. To have an object of consciousness, you need consciousness. The two sheaves of the reed. Take one away, the other one disappears. So in jhanas, yes, that is a mind consciousness, and its object, that particular nama rupa, which is in the first jhana, you know, is the vedana, perception, volition, other stuff. But it's not nama rupa, that's a whole lot. You don't have to have every part of nama rupa there. For example, in the jhanas, you don't have any rupa, you don't have the form. It's nama, not form. You don't have volition. You have certainly feeling, you have perception. You have attention, you have, what else is there? You have contact. So when it says name and form, it doesn't mean that all have to be there. At least one or two have to be there. Yes.
Manasikara,
yeah,
and that's what the whole idea of what, why we become a monk or nun is because you can spend more time training the mind. I mean, this attention doesn't just come like that; it comes from you live a pure life outside of meditation.
Very
then when
good.
When you sit in meditation, the manasikara just come, the attention just come inclined toward pure.
Yes, that is very true for some monks. Remember that monks like myself do have a lot of work to do as well, but I was fortunate to have my early years very free. I have lots of time to develop things like manasikara, yes. But many lay people can also find that time. I know many people live quite simple lives. So don't just think, no, I'm a woman, I can't do this. Yes, you can.
No, I just finished it. What I'm trying to say is that you cannot force yourself sitting and say, I'm going to get jhana. What I'm trying to say, this make the mind or train the mind. You got to, the mind is, you from outside, you come in.
Yeah, you have to, the mind has to be conditioned. I agree with you there. And again, you've heard my teachings a long time, Cheng. It is very much, you have to learn how to let go. Renounce. I mentioned that so many times. The only way to get into the jhana proper is to let go a huge amount. And it's that aspect of being a monk or a nun called renunciation. That is what empowers the monastic to get into deep meditation quickly. We renounce. We've let go of so much. That letting go of so much being a monk is what you can take further and get into the jhanas. But that doesn't mean, as a person living in the world, you can't turn on that letting go button from time to time. And also get deep meditation. Okay, better keep going on because we're spending a lot of time already, but this is good. And what is consciousness? There are these six classes of consciousness, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, consciousness. This is called consciousness. Sometimes that you can just sweep over that too quickly. These are different types of consciousness. Each one is totally different than the other ones. But why do we call each one sort of consciousness? And you've heard again my understanding of that. It is because if you see very clearly, I don't mean with your eye, but with your mind, you can perceive that every act of eye consciousness seeing is followed by mind consciousness. You see and then you know you saw. You hear, then you know you hear. So each one of those five, even when you know something, then you know that you knew something. So every act of consciousness is followed by a knowing. Otherwise it doesn't register. And that gives every type of consciousness a similarity, an appearance of sameness. So what is it you have in common between seeing and, say, hearing, tasting, touching? Why do they, there's something which is similar to them? The thing is, because once we feel, we know we felt. And is that following of every sense consciousness by mind consciousness, which gives this flow of experience, a sense of sameness. We see that we experience consciousness as a continuity. Because we hear something, we see something, it's pretty similar. Why is it similar? It's because the knowing gets in there. That is why, if you understand what this knowing is and what hearing is, seeing the two separate things, you can actually understand how the flow of consciousness is similar to the grains of sand on Scarborough Beach, which is a local beach here in Perth. This is being videoed. At a distance, it looks like a continual stretch of sand. But when you look at it closely, it's individual grains. It's individual moments of consciousness, like individual grains of sand on the beach. It's not continuous. And if you really look very closely, with even a magnifying glass, you can actually see those grains of sand are not even touching. There's spaces between them. And that's fascinating to be able to perceive that, to see the spaces between your consciousness, conscious moments. That undermines the idea that your consciousness is a continuous flow, which is part of the illusion of a self. You can see that, you know, this thing called consciousness changes. Every consciousness is totally different. Then the idea of I am the one who knows is undermined. And you can't really maintain that any longer. Seeing these are six totally different types of consciousness. In my books and other tales, I've called it the fruit salad simile, which you've heard before. A coconut is not the same as a banana. But because things flow so quickly, we think, yes, it's just consciousness. And consciousness, we haven't finished yet. Amongst are the volitional formations. This is sankhara. There are these three kinds of volitional formations: bodily, verbal, and mental volitional formations. What do you mean by body volitional formations? Can a body will something? No. What this really means, the volitional formations, the word sankhara is often associated with karma. Sankhara, we will, because we will. That's the most important part of sankhara, volitional formation. Therefore, we act with our body, with our speech, with our mind. We create karma. That's why many people translate this as not volitional formations, but karma formations. And understanding that, that is valid. That is, I understand the correct understanding of this particular phrase as karma formations, then it becomes very clear. It's bodily karma, verbal karma, mental karma, the three ways of making karma. And lastly, what is ignorance? And I usually like to call this as delusion rather than ignorance. Not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way leading to the cessation of sufferings. These are the four noble truths. I don't like the word ignorance, because everybody who comes to a place like this, most Buddhists, they know the Four Noble Truths. They're not ignorant of them. They just know them, but they don't understand them. That's the trouble. The better description is one of the descriptions which the Buddha gave of what avijja, delusion, really is. It's like taking what is suffering and thinking it's happiness, being deluded, taking what is happiness and being deluded to think it's suffering. For example, just how many people in Perth will think that coming to a Buddhist temple on a Sunday afternoon is happiness? They think you're crazy coming here. And they may be just going down to the beach, swimming and messing around and getting drunk. And they think that, yes, taking drugs and getting drunk is happiness. Is it? I say it's suffering. I say they're deluded. They say I'm deluded. Which one is right? I think we should probably know that by now. But that's what delusion is. It's what is happiness, thinking it is unhappiness. What is unhappiness, suffering, taking it to be happiness. and what is permanent, taking it to be impermanent. What is impermanent, taking it to be permanent. And lastly, what is not a self, taking it to be a self. Those are the delusions, ignorance, distortion. That's very more powerful. And you can actually see just how many people follow what they think is happiness and they suffer. And they don't look at what is truly happiness because they think it's suffering. So those are the delusion. So that is the explanation going in detail. Now, with ignorance or delusion as condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. Let's pause there for a moment. What does that really mean? From delusion, karma formations come to be. Yes. Why do we wish for something? Why do we have volitional formations? Why do we act by body, speech, or mind? Because we think by doing so, then we can be happy, then we can go to heaven and live for happily ever after, permanently. So much of our karma is based on delusion, especially, obviously, bad karma. Why did people do things like paedophilia or, you know, robbing people or pushing old people over? Why do they do that? And it's total delusion. Because of that, that is a cause for karmic activity. And due to karma, what the Buddha said, karma and also craving creates your next birth. So that's consciousness. And I'll go on to this in a few moments, why the consciousness has to be consciousness in the next life. But from consciousness causes, consciousness as a conditioner is this nama rupa. This doesn't mean in the same way that, you know, when you put the match onto the wood, then is the flame. It means that these two, without one, there can't be the other. So when we look at causality, yes, from delusion, you can say that even creates the karmic formations. It certainly bends them. And you can say that that is karma, is a very important cause for the type of consciousness you're going to have in the next life. But consciousness, does consciousness come first and then nama-rupa come afterwards, or nama-rupa come first and then consciousness? The two always have to come together. So when it says consciousness and nama-rupa, it means without one there can't be the other. And it's the same with the next few factors. Without nama-rupa, there can't be the six sense bases. Without the six sense bases, there can't be contact. Without contact, there can't be this thing we call feeling. So these two, these factors of consciousness, nama-rupa, sense bases, contact, and feeling, these all happen together. Without one, there can't be the others. That's what this part of dependent origination means. You take even any one of these away, even Vedana. You can't have any consciousness without a Vedana. You're going to have pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. You have to have one of those three. You can't have any conscious experience without contact. You can't have it, you know, without all the sense bases. You have to have at least one sense base. You have to have nama-rupa, you have to have consciousness. Each one of these are five essential they're essential factors of five things which create what we know as experience. So when it says one conditions the other, this is not a sequence. It's five things depend upon each other. You take one of those away, the others are disappeared. So that's what it means, condition, causing. Is that clear? Yes, they're together. But once we get to feeling, you know, then, you know, basically when we have consciousness, nama, rupa, contact, so sense basis, contact and feeling, then we can say those can cause, they can condition craving. You don't always get craving when you have sensory experience, but you can't have craving without sensory experience. So that's what it means, the conditioning. So sometimes it can create craving, sometimes you can just let it go. But if it creates craving, then that craving conditions the upadana. the clinging, that never made sense to me. But when you call it fuel, the craving creates this fuel which forces you into the next life. It's the gas in your car which takes you to your destination, which for you is a future birth. And that creates these states of existence. It's weird. And I've had nice arguments with physicists about this. You know, these worlds, where do they come? Do they pre-exist? Or do we actually create them with our craving and our fuel? Here, in dependent origination, it tends to point to you cause these places to exist. The craving and the fuel causes our world. That's the more difficult one to accept, but when you come to some of these other realms, like the heaven realms and the hell realms, very much that is obvious the case. If you look at the hell realms which are described in the suttas or in the temple walls, and you see these pots of boiling oil with these demons with horns and sharp forks poking you and all these other stuff, you think, my goodness, that is just so 25 centuries ago. Hell has evolved since then. There's much better ways of torturing people than pots of boiling oil. So you actually, if you go to a hell realm, you create your hell realm. Your craving, the fuel, creates that particular bhava, state of existence, where you will go to. The same with the heaven realms. When I read about the heaven realms 26 centuries ago by the Buddha, they weren't all that attractive. My goodness, living in a palace with... don't just criticize the Muslims for having, 26 black-eyed virgins if you, become a martyr. Even Saka, he had more than that. It's actually somebody... Remember, somebody... it's 500 nymphs in each of towers, of 500 towers. You know, they have this sutta about how many concubines this heavenly being had. And somebody actually worked it out, and something like 63,000,264 something. It's crazy. And my goodness, to me, that would be, I remember having a girlfriend. One girlfriend was enough suffering, 6,624. That's not my idea of heaven at all. So the point is, in those days, that's what people would imagine they would like as a heaven. If you're a man, that type of man. But, you make your own heaven. It is. Yes, go on. An objective reality, great, you've got the point. No, it's not an objective reality. These are mind-made realms. No, it's not a common one. That's a great idea. So when you go to heaven, will you meet Ronnie? Good job, she's out there, over there. Otherwise I get in trouble with this. Will you? Or will you create a being which is like Ronnie for you? Because this is a great problem these days, because how many times do people... you have a great relationship with Ronnie, but there's other people. Say you go, I'm sure Jacob won't mind me saying this. Jacob was married before, and suppose he still love his wife, but if he loved his former wife, but his former wife didn't love him, then what would happen? He was such a good guy, done lots of good karma, so Jacob at least will go to heaven. Does that mean your wife has to go there and put up with you again because you still love her but she doesn't love you? What would actually happen? Because no, you love her so much. Heaven, I can't call it heaven without the person I love the most in this world. For you. But for her, that's like being in hell, being with you. So what? How can we resolve this? This wonderful thing about relationships. And of course, what would happen is... you would create your Ronnie. You create your wife.
You mean those 500 demons?
Totally created by his sex-addicted mind of Saka.
Just
yeah, basically, yeah. Just generated.
It's not another being.
Not another beings. That would be terrible. 6,000 or a million nymphs, having to pull up with this guy. You know, would that be anyone's idea of heaven? Okay, for Saka it's heaven, but for the nymphs, that's really hell. And having to pull up with him and, you know, pander to his every wish. So no, these are created. And, you know, you create custom... Not on this earth, no. This is custom-made mind realm. So in your heaven, you know, in your heaven you would have, you know, noodles and Chinese food every day. That would be hell for me. So what food are you going to have in hell? Do they serve the same food to everybody up in heaven? No, you make your own food. So this is the idea of the craving and the fuel creating these states of existence. Now, what I was always fascinated, how does that work in this human realm when we do actually share, you know, an earth which is common to each one of us, or do we? How much of this world do we share, and how much do we create? Is my Australia the same as yours? And that's something I haven't sort of concluded that investigation yet, because we assume it's the same. We live in the same country, for goodness sake. But my perception and experience of Australia will always be different than yours. So how much of it is in common? How much of it is created by us? Are they independent beings? This is a great thing. Yeah, we sort of interact together. But how much of this is personally created? And how much of it is pre-existing, which we just live in? Do we build our house? Some of you move into an old house, but some of you create your new house. How much of this human existence is moving into an old house? And how much of it is custom built by you? That's a question. I won't give an answer because I'm still figuring that out myself. Anyway, you can see just how this whole process of creation of existence is. Not a God creating it. So that's why when people ask me, who created this world? Delusion and craving created this world. That's a much powerful understanding than just a God. And of course, once we have this existence, then we have a birth, we have a place to get reborn into, a place to arise in. And then we have the old age, suffering and death of another life. Yeah, go on. Okay, in the mind-made realm, just how detailed can it actually be? Have you ever spoken to someone, you know, suffering that terrible disease of schizophrenia, where what they believe they see, what they believe they hear, is far more real than what we would call reality? I remember just reading one article of a fellow who'd managed to find his way out of schizophrenia and was describing some of the experiences. He says once he saw like a human head just roll across the floor in front of him. The reason said that cannot exist. But it was more real to him than, you know, the walls and the floor on which he was sitting on. And it's a very great insight in actually to what is actually happening. And this is just a human condition when you still have a body. Imagine what you can do and how much you create when you're not limited by the very difficult stuff to mold, like the dry clay which won't be molded of this human existence. When it gets to those heavenly realms, you have almost 100% freedom to mold and create the heaven what you want and create the hell which you think you deserve. That's such an important insight for me to see, especially the hell realms. No one ever sends you down to hell. You send yourself down to hell, and you create that hell which you think you deserve. Yeah. The nymphs, are they talking, or what are they doing? Because if you, are they real or are they mind-made creations of Sakya in that particular realm? I would sort of put my money, if I had any, on mind-made creations of Sakya, of that God, creating that realm to suit himself. Yes. Basically, yeah. But retinue of the devas, yes. But how many of those are created? There'll probably be a few people there who can actually communicate with real people. But how much of those are mind-made? How many people, you know, especially when you're young, it's another interesting thing. They have their imaginary playmates who are real as anything. Then if you... I never had any imaginary playmates. I had too many real playmates. Did you have imaginary playmates when you were 2, 3, 4 years of age? There we go. Were they real?
Yeah.
But were they real? You. As far as we're concerned, they're real. But this is how we can create things. This is one of the great understandings of getting into deep meditation. How powerful is your mind? I remember even... reading this, one of the first Buddhist books I read by Alexandra David Neal. She was this French lady who went over to Tibet where you could still go in there before the war. She wrote some amazing little anecdotes and stories. But one of them was where, you know, she was meditating for a long time in a cave by herself, and she actually created a being, so she said. And that was really weird. How can you actually create a being just by willing it, wishing it to create a being which would follow her around? Until, I don't know if I should say this, but you know, Ajahn Sumedho told me he did the same thing once, created a being. This is a person I know could use powerful meditation to create something. Could other people see that? If you create a strong one, yes, they can. Now we're really getting into interesting mental stuff. The power of the mind, you don't understand how powerful it is.
What is being created by the mind, of the mind, is actually the mind a controller creating something.
Exactly, it's a controller creating something. It's not a good thing to do. It's a stupid thing to do. But I'm saying it can happen even in this human existence, even in this really solid, tough world of bricks and sort of concrete. Exactly. Merchant of Brahm. Maybe for you. No, I think it's me. But don't remember in Buddhism they have that trick of creating many bodies. It's one of the psychic powers. From one body you can create many. Yeah, apparently, yes. How can it be done? You can create these things. Never underestimate the power of this human mind. Most people, their mind is just so scattered and concerned with just mundane matters, you don't get the opportunity to develop that great strength. But when you get into these deep meditations, you know, you feel you have the power. If you really wanted to do things like that, you know, you could start on that path. You know, many of you had deep meditations, you can feel you've got that power, that strength, that energy. It's just whether you really want to go in that direction or not. So this is a human realm, again, which is really hard to mold. The other realms, it's so easy to mold. But this is an interesting part of the dependent origination. This is how you can create worlds. So the heaven realms, yeah?
Isn't it the same in the vivid dream?
Vivid dreams, you're dreaming. What was that saying by, was it Plato? You know, the simile of the cave, you know, are you, or the butterfly, are you, asleep, are you a person dreaming of a butterfly, or you're a butterfly, a real butterfly, and you dream you're a man when you're awake, which is the reality. Because he had a dream that he was a butterfly, Plato, flying through the air in his beautiful dream. When he woke up, he was back to being a Greek again. Which is the real me? Am I a butterfly dreaming I'm a human being? Or am I a human being dreaming they're a butterfly? And there's no way you could actually prove either. That was the interesting part of it. Are you dreaming that you're a human being? And when you go to sleep at night, is that when you really wake up? I've got to be careful here because this might just blow your mind. I better go back to Greylands. Please don't do that. But this is just the fascinating part of dependent origination. Craving, wanting, and the delusion create worlds. And then you live in those worlds, and it's old age and death, it's suffering. It's not worth creating any world, no matter what world, it all sucks. So anyway, now I want to go to, I've only got to so far, I've only got that far, as usual. Really good, to, okay. We've got origination and cessation. I'll just go through this pretty quickly. This is 10. Origination. Monks, before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, and I always keep saying this, whenever he mentions the word bodhisattva, it's always preceded by before my enlightenment. In other words, in Theravada teachings of the Buddha, a bodhisattva is always before enlightenment. Not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, alas, this world has fallen into trouble in that it is born, ages, and dies. It passes away and is reborn, yet it does not understand the escape from this suffering headed by aging and death. In other words, how can I stop being reborn? Where now will an escape be discerned from this suffering headed by aging and death? Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does aging and death come to be? In other words, what's the cause of aging and death? By then, because through careful attention, there took place in me the breakthrough of by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition. That may seem obvious. Yeah, of course, you know, when you're born, you have to age and die. But what is really important to him, he said, when you get reborn, you have to get it done all over again. So the only way to stop getting old and dying is to stop getting reborn. But then, how do you stop getting reborn? Then it occurred to me, when what exists does birth come to be? By what is birth conditioned? Then, because through careful attention, there came to me a breakthrough by wisdom, when there is existence, the place you can get reborn into, then birth comes to be. Birth has these states of existence as its condition. Then it occurred to me, when what exists does states of existence come to be? By what is existence conditioned? Then, monks, with careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is clinging or fuel, then states of existence come to be. States of existence have this fuel as a condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does this fuel called upadana or clinging come to be? By what is this fuel conditioned? Then, because through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is craving, this fuel comes to be. Craving. This fuel has craving as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does craving come to be? But what is craving conditioned? Then, monks, with careful attention, it took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom, when there is feeling. You know, there's pleasure and pain. Now, you can see why he chose pleasure and pain at this point, because that is the core reason why we crave. We want to get rid of pain, we want to get more pleasure. That's the cause. So what exists does feeling come to be? By what is feeling conditioned? Then because through careful attention it took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom, when there is this contact, this physical experience, this sensory experience. I would prefer calling sensory experience rather than contact, because contact doesn't really sort of make much impact into people. We've called it sensory experience. When there's sensory experience, then there will always be some type of feeling. So when what exists does sensory experience come to be? By what is sensory experience conditioned? Then because through careful attention it took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom, when there are six sense bases, then sensory experience comes to be. Sensory experience has a six sense basis as it's conditioned. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists do the six sense bases come to be? What are the six sense bases conditioned? Then because through careful attention to place in me the breakthrough by wisdom, when there's this nama rupa, then there must be the six sense bases, because that's part of nama rupa. So the six sense bases have name and form, or nama rupa as a condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does name and form come to be? Nama rupa, by what is nama rupa conditioned? Then, monks, with careful attention that took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom, when there is consciousness, this nama-rupa comes to be. In other words, when you're conscious, you have conscious objects. When you have conscious objects, you have consciousness. And then monks, it occurred to me, when what exists, does consciousness come to be? By what is consciousness conditioned? Then monks, with careful attention, that took place in me, breakthrough by wisdom, where there is karma formations, consciousness comes to be. Volitional formations. Consciousness has volitional formations as it's conditioned. Then monks, it occurred to me, when what exists, do volitional formations come to be? By what are volitional formations conditioned? Then monks, through careful attention, that took place in me, the breakthrough by wisdom, when there is delusion, karma formations come to be, delusions, so karma formation have delusion as a condition. Thus, with delusion as condition, volitional or karma formations, with volitional formations, consciousness, and so on, such is this origin of this whole mass of suffering. Origination. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, truth, and light. Now, I'd went through that very quickly because I just want to spend a little bit more time on cessation. Because in Buddhism, everyone talks about dependent origination. Even when I was in Korea, the Zen master there talked about dependent origination. But I much prefer dependent cessation. So this is the cessation part. So don't just call dependent origination. That's depressing. Dependent cessation, that rocks. So dependent cessation. Then monks, it occurred to me, when what does not exist, does aging and death not come to be? That's when we take something away, what destroys aging and death? With the cessation of what does the cessation of aging and death come about? Then monks, with careful attention, it took place in me, the breakthrough by wisdom, when there is no birth, then aging and death does not come to be. With the cessation of birth, or I think we could actually say pretty accurately, with the cessation of rebirth, there is a cessation of aging and death. Because this birth you can't cease. You're stuffed, you've been born, it cannot be undone. Your next birth, you can undo that. With the cessation of rebirth comes the cessation of aging and death. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what does not exist, does rebirth not come to be? By the cessation of what does the cessation of rebirth come about? Then, monks, with careful attention, that took place in me, a breakthrough by wisdom, when there is no states of existence, rebirth does not come to be. With the cessation of these states of existence, no place to get reborn into, comes a cessation of rebirth. When there is no fuel, then the states of existence don't come to be. They're not created. The cessation of the fuel comes a cessation of states of existence. When there is no craving, then the states of existence do not come to be. The cessation of craving comes a cessation of... Sorry, this I blew that one. When there is no craving, the fuel does not come to be. The cessation of craving comes a cessation of the fuel. When there is no feeling, then craving does not come to be. With the cessation of feeling comes a cessation of craving. When there is no contact, feeling does not come to be. With the cessation of sensory experience comes a cessation of feeling. When there are no six sense bases, sensory experience does not come to be. With the cessation of the six sense bases comes a cessation of sensory experience. When there is no nama rupa, the six sense bases do not come to be. With the cessation of nama rupa comes the cessation of the six sense bases. When there is no consciousness, nama rupa does not come to be. With the cessation of nama rupa comes the cessation of name and form. When there are no volitional formations, consciousness does not come to be. With the cessation of volitional formations comes cessation of consciousness. When there is no delusion, volitional formations do not come to be. With the cessation of delusion comes the cessation of volitional formations. So you work backwards. And so, he realized the way out of existence. Thus, with a remainderless fading away and cessation of delusion comes a cessation of volitional formations. I'm going to pause there because someone who is enlightened, an arahat, they have totally overcome delusion, such as the Buddha, such as Sariputra and Moggallana. They've overcome delusion. So for them, delusion has faded away. Does that mean their volitional formations have also faded away? Did the Buddha have any volitional formations? Didn't he? Didn't he have any will? Did he decide to make a sangha, to have bhikkhunis, to teach the Dhamma? Ah, very good. Now these are volitional formations which create karma vipaka, this is the result of karma, in a future life. Obviously, that his volitional formations did have resultant karma in this life. His actions created a sangha, but they don't have karmic results for him in a future life. In other words, it's not rebirth producing karma. But certainly he did karma. So you can say, okay, volitional formations, those volitional formations which are going to create karma in a future life have been destroyed. But what about, said, with the cessation of volitional formation comes the cessation of consciousness? So did the Buddha, as soon as he was enlightened, become unconscious? Was the Buddha, or Sariputta, or Moggallana, conscious beings? Of course they were. So hang on. But it says here, with the cessation of ignorance, delusion, comes the cessation of consciousness. How can you explain that? Of course. For the Arahat, a Buddha, a Sariputta, Moggallana, delusion is totally overcome. But what does it mean, the cessation of ignorance, a cessation of consciousness? When does the consciousness of an Arahat cease? At their parinibbana, at the end of their human life. That's when the consciousness stops forever. That is where the cessation is. So with the cause and effect, sometimes it's not that the effect follows immediately after the cause. No way, in a similar way, it says here that birth is a condition for old age and death. It doesn't mean as soon as you are born, you have cracked teeth. Actually, you have no teeth. But aging and death comes a little bit after when you're born. There is a time delay. Yes, it's going to happen, but it doesn't happen immediately after birth that you get old, sick, and die. It takes a time. As I can see, it's taken you a long time to get, well, maybe, you know, 40, 50, 60 years to get to old age, sickness, and a bit longer to get to death. There's a time delay there. In the same way with the destruction, cessation of delusion, there is a time delay before consciousness ceases. And that consciousness, the only way you can logically explain this is the consciousness at the end of this life, no more rebirth consciousness. That is one of the strong arguments which I have used to argue against such interpretations that of Jnanavira, Buddhadasa, that this is all about just one life. In fact, that I've often taught that it is this teaching of dependent origination was the Buddha's idea of how this whole process of rebirth does happen without a soul, without a being getting reborn. It's a whole process. It's a process of nama-rupa and consciousness, of six sense bases and sensory experience and vedana, of clinging. It's this whole process which is what gets reborn. Not a person, but a process. And unfortunately, I won't have time to talk about that in later on, but here, the process is stopping. With the cessation of delusion, soon the process will stop at the end of your life. That's when consciousness stops. And obviously, when consciousness ceases, once there is no more consciousness, consciousness has ceased. It's not just any type of consciousness. All the six consciousness have ceased. Not just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, but mind consciousness as well ceased. You're not going to a realm of pure mind living happily ever after. It is ceased. When that ceases, the objects of consciousness cease, the nama rupa. There are no more sense bases. There are no more sensory experience, no more vedana, no more happiness or suffering of any type. Because that's one of the problems. You think, no. I've worked so hard to become enlightened. When this has ceased, I want to be happy, for goodness sake. I've worked, I deserve. I don't deserve nothing. Is that the goal of Buddhism? No consciousness, no nama rupa, no sense bases at all, nothing to experience, no happiness, no suffering. Yeah, I can take the no suffering business, but leave me the happiness. And that's what it says here. It's a tough thing to accept, but it's right there. If you understand it, it's a wonderful thing to accept. And with the cessation of Vedana, there can't be any more craving, no more fuel. You won't create any more states of existence, no more birth, no more death, no more suffering. Such is the end, the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Cessation, cessation. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. Yes. Yes. Then that is created by the person who's meditating. It's not a real being. In the same way that when you go to a heaven realm, you'll create Ronnie. For you, it'll be just as real as she is in this life. She'll still argue with you up in heaven. Could you like that? Okay. Yeah, go on, Cheng. Could you do you get the microphone to Chen? Yeah. Come on. This is not just you ask very good questions, and this is for everybody else as well. Yeah, I know you can't express, but what you're saying is very good.
Could you just Ajahn Brahm, could you just kindly elaborate a bit on this through careful attention? Okay. There took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom.
Okay, this careful.
How, or at least a quick run, how involved? Because people are so interested in doing insight. I must have it now, I must have insight now. I think by this stage of so many years, I think people should get a bit of understanding how this thing can happen. And I think
exactly.
In a happy world like Australia, we should try to get as jhana and.
Yeah.
Okay,
it is very good. No, it is. It's a very good point. You always ask good questions. It is careful attention. And there is one teaching I'm going to repeat again, which I've shared with many people, is I did have the very good fortune to meet with Venerable Nyanaponika. He's a great German scholar. That was in the Hermitage over in Kandy. He was about to die soon. And we were talking about some controversy in the suttas. And he said something to me, which I was a brilliant little anecdote, and which I try to live by. He said, you should never interpret the Buddha's teachings on the basis of one or two obscure passages in the suttas. Because there are some obscure passages, they're ambiguous, they could be read one of two ways. Don't take those ambiguous passages and then interpret the meaning of what the Buddha said everywhere else. He said, take the consistent message in the suttas, repeat it again and again and again, and interpret the ambiguous passages in light of the mass of consistent, easily understood teachings of the Buddha. That's very good advice, because I see many people just making that mistake. You know, get one or two obscure passages and try to interpret the whole of the teachings in light of that. So you have here wise attention. How can you interpret that in light of the rest of the Buddha's teachings? And especially you're talking about how we can use that to break through, to become enlightened. And the mass of teachings, which is consistent throughout Buddhism, is the Eightfold Path. That's a massive teaching repeated again and again and again. So once more, if you want to become enlightened, it's the Eightfold Path. Not just wise attention, not vipassana, the whole Eightfold Path. That's where you look at something like Yonisamanasikara. Where does that fit in to the Eightfold Path? That is part of mindfulness and also part of samadhi, stillness as well. And that is where, looking at the meaning of that term, Yonisa Manasikara. And when you study some of the Pali, sometimes you've got to be careful, because sometimes if you study the words, you know, one by one, sometimes you can get a bad interpretation. In the same way you study the word, together. What does the word together mean? And so you analyze it, what together means, into three parts. To get her. That was together, what it means to be together. And so you can see how you can analyze a word into parts and get totally the wrong meaning. Now, so you've got to always be careful when you say yonisa manasikara. But I think it's pretty accurate. Yonisa means to the womb, from the womb or to the womb. The word yoni is a Pali word meaning like the womb, you know, where things come from, the origin. And that is why yonisa manasikara literally means work of the mind which goes to the source, attention which goes to the source of things. Now, I've often used that for jhanas, but here, in this context, you can see what it could mean. It's the work of the mind which goes to the source, the origin of things. Aging and death, where does that come from? That comes from birth. Where does birth come from? That comes from this bhava, this state of existence. Where does state of existence come from? That comes from fuel, clinging. Where does that come from? That comes from craving. Where does craving come from? This vedana. Where does vedana come from? This is what is very easily understood. This is the Buddha's inquiry. It goes to the source of things. Where does this come from? Why does this happen? Now that is Buddhism. So when it comes wise attention, especially wise attention, which really means here, yonisa manasikara, work of the mind which goes back to the source, you see in this context it's not jhanas, it's actually investigation, where does this come from? So that is a wise attention here, and you can see an example of this. Aging and death, why aging and death? Where does this come from? From birth. Consciousness, where did consciousness come from? What's its source? What's its origin? That's dependent origination. So that's why it's a very good question. Yeah? Exactly. Exactly. Yes, I think that's why. Yeah. What you're saying again is very true. It's not when you say jhanas, it's not just the experience of jhana, it's what jhana does to the mind afterwards. Clearing of the hindrances, being able to see very clearly what's happening, but also the data of jhana too. I did print out a lot here. It's been a long time since I did a sutta class, so that's why we didn't finish. I thought we'd do more. But nevertheless, we've done quite a lot here. When's the next time I'm going to teach? Might be a while. So maybe if you can hand in these pieces of paper back, and I'll keep them for the next time I do a sutta class, and I can continue on with the nutriment and Molya Paguna. These are great sutras, and the Kachana Gota, these brilliant sutras, but maybe hand them in so I can do part two the next time I do the sutta class. Very good. Okay, so thank you all for coming. I won't be able to do them, it's too late. Because are they, or maybe, I know there's some in the box. Okay, come on quickly, we'll do it. We should do this, because people have been looking in. So no more questions from the floor, we have some questions here from and I'll try and be very quickly. I'll do the ones from overseas, first of all. Adam from USA. Ajahn, if you're reborn as a human being after an existence in a form sphere realm, say you're reborn in this human life having already attained stream winning in a previous life, would your faculties already be refined and your hindrances weak enough for it to be possible to progress to arahatship in this life without re-experiencing the jhanas? It makes total sense to me that jhanas are necessary for liberation, but does that necessarily mean that they are necessary to be re-experienced in this life for complete liberation? The essence of the answer is the jhanas, they are just what happens when you let go, when you disappear. It's not that you have to experience them, you can't avoid experiencing them. As you become enlightened, you get let go more and more. You know, there's no need to think. There's no need to do anything. And because there's no need to, you just don't do anything. You become more and more still. The jhanas are like the default state of the arahat. Just like if you don't move your mouse on the computer, what happens after a couple of seconds? Or minutes maybe, your computer turns off. It goes to the screensaver. So the jhanas are the screensavers. It's just what happens when you're not doing anything. And the arupas are just what happens when the screensaver is there for a while. It just, the computer screen goes to sleep. But there's another little piece here. If you're reborn, if you've already attained to being a stream winner at Adam, it's an interesting thing, but if you understand what's going on here, this is an amazing truth. If you're a stream winner in this life and you get a jhana, so at the end of your life, you're reborn in the jhana realms. That is your last life. When the jhana vanishes in that realm, then you're parinibbana, you cease. You never come back again. They call that jhana anagami, a jhana anagami. You have to be a stream winner first, and you've got lots of jhanas, so the next life is in the rupa loka, arupa loka, that is your last life. You never come back again, anywhere. And it's impossible not to do anything else. So hopefully I answered that. The jhanas are necessary or not necessary. These are just stages of letting go. Letting go is necessary to become enlightened. That's why the jhanas are just what you will experience, whether you like it or not. And Josh, again from US, he asked a question on Friday, or Saturday. How do you know if you are reaching deeper levels of meditation? Is it something that is just understood when you arrive? When you're in there, you're not quite sure where you are, but when you come out, my goodness, you know that something has happened. These are called Uttari Manusa Dhamma by the Buddha. You know, superior, extreme human experiences. These are not ordinary. They're, you know, Uttari means above ordinary human experience. So you know that something extraordinary has happened. It's not, oh, that was just a nice meditation. No, this is extraordinary. So it blows your mind, as I used to say in the 60s. Wow, this was amazing. What the heck was this? And so it's a powerful experience. So that's one of the reasons why you know. And there's lots of other ways of knowing, but that's where you have to ask the teacher. You are like you weren't there. Like the Christians would say, it was union with God. These are just huge experiences. As one person here said, it's like a big kick up the backside of your existence, bigger than you've ever had before. You never expected that to happen. And that's why it can give you the bigger kick so that you can overcome everything. After death, how long should I expect my awareness to remain with the body? Is it possible I will have bodily awareness during an autopsy? Very, very unlikely. You have no expectations at all. But I am a organ donor. I'm very happy to have an autopsy and to give my organs, because by that time, yeah, you may not be totally past the medical point of death, but you usually left your body at that time. They can take your organs. It's no problem at all. People say, but no, when they take the organs, they can see twitching happen and other stuff. It means you're still consciousness, because somebody told me that when their father died recently or something, that they were by the bedside and they looked into his eyes, he'd gone. They knew he'd gone, he died, but he was still breathing. So it was weird. And he still was breathing one more breath and still twitching, because he had a twitch at the end, but she knew he'd gone. And I said, exactly. I've never done this, and hopefully you never do it, but I've heard cutting a chicken's head off. If you cut the chicken's head off, it's dead. But it runs around the yard. I've never seen that. Have you seen that? Some people have anyway. That's exactly what happens. The body is still working, but it's automatic. You're dead. So even they may find a few twitches when they take out your heart. You're not feeling anything. You're dead. It's just the same phenomena as a chicken with its head cut off running around the yard. It's dead. There are lots of psychic powers developed by people in this world who have access to communicate with higher beings. Most of them don't trust, you know, it's not higher beings they're talking with. Ask the question, would higher beings be talking with them? higher beings have got much better jobs to do than talk with humans. So it's, one, it's conceit, and number two, it's usually just imagination. Lord Buddha was ordained under Kassapa the Buddha and the chief high jhana. If then, why he couldn't communicate with Brahma, who knows middle way to achieve enlightenment easily without trying different methods for so long? Exactly. Brahma Sahampati had much more important things to do. So don't think that communicating with higher beings is going to make you enlightened. That is not their job. Their time scale is totally different. Is there any meditation method to see higher beings and planes? See higher beings, the only way you can see higher beings is actually to use a telescope, and you might see the Singapore Airlines and Qantas flying at 36,000 feet. That's the only higher beings you'll ever see. And other beings as a layperson. Why do you want to do that? Number one, unlikely you'll be able to do that at all. Can a person transfer good karma to another being? Doing that, will that give a losing his good karma? What are the minimum conditions a person requires to achieve another person's metta to develop his mindfulness? This is transferring karma to one another. If, yes, it can be done, and you don't lose anything. When you give, you always get back. So the Buddha said, if you give or transfer your merits to another being, it's the same as lighting a candle, which is not lit yet, from another candle. The original candle does not lose any of its flame. And of course, people ask, well, can you transfer merits to people who are still alive? Yes, you can. I've been transferring my merits to you for the past hour and 40 minutes. That is how merits are transferred when you're still alive, by being kind, by caring, by giving. So that's the answers. So I did it very quickly because I did go over time. And today is our Upasatha day, so I have to get back to monastery because we're doing the Patimokkha chanting. So sorry I can't be around for too long.